Mark, you're a fully qualified scientist. You have an interest in the history of science, published work in the history of science. How can somebody with those academic credentials believe in a person who can't be detected with the five senses, or who doesn't even show up in a scientific experiment? You know, how can a rational person believe in something like that?
I think starting there, I almost want to stop you and say, this is scientism. You're making an as you start with a question like that, you're making the assumption that the only proper apparatus to answer any questions we might have is the apparatus of science. And there's a famous physical scientist, Peter Atkins, an atheist at the University of Oxford, and he says, science is omnipotent. Science answers all questions. And I think that's simply false. I think there are classes of questions which science doesn't answer. I'm not convinced it can make statements on ethics. I'm not convinced it can adjudicate on beauty. It might be able to make partial coverage of those, but certainly not total coverage. I'm not convinced it can make statements on logic. Logic is just foundational. It's almost pre-science. And I'm not convinced it can make statements on some things which we all accept, but which we couldn't possibly prove. So ideas like, we're not brains in vats. Or, well, none of us believe we're brains in vats. Well, could you get a scientist to prove that for us, please? Or that the universe didn't pop into existence 5 minutes ago and we've got complete memories of it. Mm-hmm. Can we prove that didn't happen scientifically? Well, no, we can't. That's no harm to science. That's just saying that there are some things that science can't do. That's kind of a sideline in your question. That's just me being cheeky to an interviewer in his first question, I suppose.
That's not very well used.
I guess what I would want to say is, when I think of the existence of God, I'm thinking of, you don't use science to interrogate God. You use the idea of God to make sense of science, to make sense of the entire shooting match, why there is anything at all, why we can make sense of it, why it is well structured. There's a very good quote from C.S. Lewis. He wrote an essay in the mid-1940s. I think it was called Is Theology Poetry, of all titles? And he says this in it. It's a famous quote. I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen. Not only because I see it, but because by it, I see everything else. And I think God, as far as I'm concerned, as a Christian who happens to be a scientist, God is what enables me to look at the world and make sense of it, including the idea of science itself.
So is there a danger of maybe scientists, you know, getting into a God-did-it frame of mind, wherever we just use God to explain anything that looks a little bit mysterious or to get us out of difficult problems? Is there not a danger of scientists, you know, of God being sort of a science stopper in some sense?
So that's the famous God of the gaps.
Yes.
So this goes back to at least Charles Coulson, who was professor of theoretical chemistry and then professor of mathematics at the University of Oxford, and also happened to be a Methodist lay reader. Mm-hmm. And he pointed out that this idea of the God of the gaps argument was a really big mistake, because science by definition expands, it discovers more, that's what science does, it wants to work out how the physical world ticks. Mm-hmm. And scientists are good at that, and so the more they discover, then there's smaller bits that we don't understand, and if we put God in the bits that we don't understand, well, we don't understand that bit of science, so God must have done that. Then you end up with God getting smaller and smaller and smaller until there's no, quotes, God at all. And again, I think that's a wrong way of looking at science. When I come to science, when I studied physics as an undergraduate, I didn't go to my electromagnetism lectures and have lectures about Maxwell's equations, how electricity and magnetism are unified with optics. Didn't come to the end of the lecture course and said, oh, well, there you go, no room for God in that then, because we understand all that. Quite the reverse, genuinely reverse. I thought something much more like, my word, that's how ye did it. The heavens do indeed declare the glory of God. Science giving us the mechanism doesn't make God, quote, smaller. In my world, it just makes God more wonderful when we can understand how the Creator did these things, whether it be electromagnetism, quantum mechanics, or cosmology.
So has there not been an age-old conflict, though, between Christians and scientists? Have the two not been in conflict?
Has there? Oh, sorry, I wasn't aware of that.
Well, it would be a popular point of view. I mean, you know, the God delusion books like this would seem to feel that
I'm being cheeky against my interviewer again. Well, certainly someone like Richard Dawkins is the most famous modern proponent of what in the business is called the conflict model. Mm. And it's awfully convenient to set up this warfare between science and religion and say, well, there can only be one winner, and look at all the great things science has done for us. And, you know, if you're a scientist, it's almost as if the default position is, if you're a scientist, you must be an atheist. One level, I just don't get that. And certainly in terms of the history of science and religion, the idea that there has been this warfare, that the Christian church has always been opposed to science, and science has always been chipping away at the authority base of Christendom, is bluntly just plain false. I mean, obviously, and you know, history's always interesting and never simple. When we get single dominant narratives to describe large bits of history, then I tend to be very suspicious. So I think that in the past there have been individual theologians or individual groupings within the church, broadly termed, which have had problems with some aspects of science or individual scientists, or indeed there have been individual scientists who have been antagonistic towards religion. But I'm not convinced that it's certainly not the only model, and I'm certainly not convinced it's the dominant model. All you have to do is, if that were the case, then you wouldn't find any scientists who were Christians, would you?
And do we have Christians who are scientists in history?
Well, so my own area of interest in terms of the history of science broadly falls within the 19th century and 19th century physics. And the three biggest names in British 19th century physics, and that means among the three biggest names in 19th century physics full stop, are Lord Kelvin, who was born in Belfast, James Clerk Maxwell, who was a Scot and now considered to be one of the greatest physicists of all time. He's ranked with Newton and Einstein. And George Gabriel Stokes, who's actually another Irishman, were all Christians. They didn't have a problem. And they were all very upfront about their Christianity. It isn't for nothing that when James Clerk Maxwell was elected to the first Cavendish chair at the University of Cambridge and spent a heck of a lot of his time on site building the Cavendish laboratory, that he had a quote from the Psalms in Latin put above the door. It's because he reckoned that what he was doing was revealing God's works and God's glory in nature.
So just to finish, what reasons would you give for believing in God? If this were to ask you to simply summarise why you believed in God, do you have an answer?
I think there are multiple takes on this. I'm a quite simple person, so I like to give simple answers. And I would sum it up in three words. There are laws. And more than three words, there are laws, and therefore I expect a lawgiver. And so the first set of laws, and I would talk about laws in two senses. The first set are the laws of nature. So in my world, the laws of physics. Now, the laws of physics are remarkably elegant. One of the things in terms of 20th century physics is that physicists bluntly go looking for beautiful mathematics to describe the physical world. And in fact, if the mathematics isn't beautiful, isn't elegant, then they have been known to reject it out of court.
Right.
So we've got the laws of nature are described very elegantly. And bottom up, they describe the huge physical structure that we're in and all the complexity of anything from an atom up to a supercluster. And I find myself wondering, so what, we just got lucky? Where did these laws come from? It's not just enough to say, well, we're in the universe, laws are just brute facts. I genuinely am not happy with that. But there's a second class of laws, and that's called the moral law. Now, the moral law is different from the laws of physics. So golf balls and cricket balls don't have any choice when it comes to the laws of physics. Okay, they gotta follow the rules. When it comes to morality, we're in a different position because we can disobey the laws of morality. And far be it for me to quote C.S. Lewis again, but in one of Lewis's most famous books, Mere Christianity, he starts the book, and the book was actually initially broadcast talks during the war, by asking people to imagine overhearing people having an argument. So let that person sit down, they were there first. Or give me a piece of your apple, I give you a piece of mine. He says, the interesting thing when you listen, overhear those conversations, is underneath those disagreements is an idea of fairness, an idea of oughtness. Certain things are morally right, and certain things are not. And Lewis famously says, and I believe people did write into the BBC when he used this on air, he says, look, you don't come away from these arguments hearing somebody say, to hell with your morals, right? What they do is they try to explain why they haven't obeyed the rule this time. There was some extenuating circumstance that made it okay. It seems to me for all humans, apart from psychopaths, of which there are a few, we all have this inbuilt sense of fairness, sense of oughtness, a basic moral law. Now, where does that come from? And I think there's a follow-on from that, because whereas a natural place in theism, to put it, is this is the divine imprint on us, if we move to an atheist position, I think there's a real problem there. And I think in terms of our agreed ideas of ethical behaviours, and we do have them, if we move God out of the picture, then we will have difficulty in justifying them, moving from the, I think the famous Humean line is moving from a, you can't get from an is to an ought if they're only physical things, but we'll maybe come to that later.
Well, aren't there good atheists? Are there good atheists?
Oh, flip, yes. I mean, my goodness, most of the atheists I know are more moral than me. And in the sense that they're nicer guys, they all actually happen to be guys. They're much more sensible, much more evenly tempered and balanced people than I am. I mean, I'll not name them on camera, but of course they can be, and that's because we're all human, and from a Christian perspective, we all got the divine moral imprint, and whether or not we can all choose to ignore it. But I don't think whether you're a communist or a conservative or an atheist or a theist defines whether or not you're more likely to do it.
Would you not be impressed by scientific attempts to explain the origins of morality, maybe on our evolutionary history, or you know, as a way of coping in the wilderness, you know, a way of forming group cohesion, these sorts of explanations?
Impressed. I'm not sure impressed is the word I used. Okay, let's give the ground in that. Let's say that our ethical behavior is purely come about for evolutionary advantage. So it increases herd cohesion, and you've got a more stable herd, then you've got a group which can reproduce more efficiently, and therefore that outpopulates everything else. That's a sort of evolutionary narrative. Or let's say that's true. Well, I think an atheist is probably pushed into a position like that. Mm-hmm. Now, again, my view is, well, okay, if you want to go for that line, that's fine. But fess up. You make sure you make it clear that you're telling people that that is what these ethical norms are. They're just sociobiology. They're not actually oughts. So if you know, again, to use Lewis's phrase, well, why can't I say, what the hell with the society's moral standards then? I don't particularly like them. I mean, it may be inconvenient for society to me become a regular thief, but it's not actually morally wrong. And so an atheist position of morals, as I understand it, I can't understand it to be able to come to anything but that. Those may indeed be the facts of the matter, but I consider that to be a very weak position. And I also think that it just doesn't chime with how we actually think. You know, you push people in a corner and prod them, ultimately, they're really going to want to say, well, no, actually, certain things just are wrong. It's got nothing to do with society. It's just wrong to do it. And how dare you say it otherwise?